Well, we're happy that you all come out, because we think Betty has something really important to share. And this is part of the Custer Fremont Historical Society, Custer Chapter. And Betty will be talking on the one-room schoolhouse and more, right?
Well, actually, I'm supposed to talk about the impact that the curriculum had on values, and then I was also supposed to say a few words about the use of the schoolhouses other than for school.
Okay. Well, we'll let her go ahead and talk about that. She lived through it. And we're very happy to have Betty Munson with us tonight.
We have over here some pictures of some of the old one-room schools of Custer County. And keeping that in mind, especially some of these, this one, and this one. And I'll start out by with a poem called In School Days. Still sits the schoolhouse by the road, a ragged beggar sunning. Around it still the sumac grow, and blackberry vines are sunning. Within the master's desk is seen, deep scarred by Rapp's official, the warping floor, the battered seat, the jackknife's carved initial. The charcoal frescoes on its wall, its door worn still, betraying the feet that creeping slow to school went storming out to play. Long years ago, a winter's sun shone over it at setting, lit up its western window panes and low eaves' icy fretting. It touched the tangled golden curls and brown eyes full of grieving of one who still her step delayed when all the school were leaving. For near her stood the little boy, her childish favor singled, its cap pulled low upon a face where pride and shame were mingled. Pushing with restless feet the snow to right and left, he lingered, and restlessly her tiny hand the blue-checked apron fingered. He saw her lift her eyes. He felt the soft hand's light caressing and heard the tremble of her voice as if a fault confessing. I'm sorry that I spelt the word. I hate to go above you because the brown eyes lower fell because, you see, I love you. Still memory to a gray-haired man, the sweet child's face is showing. Dear girl, the grasses on her grave have 40 years been growing. He lives to learn in life's hard school how few who pass above him lament their triumph and his loss like her because they love him. And I thought it rather apropos to read that because the schoolhouses that are still in existence here in this county, many of them are ragged beggars. And it's really a shame because they should be preserved. And Irene and Stan are working very hard to do as much as possibly can be done to preserve the school and the heritage we have from those rural schools. I would like to, before I start on my official topic, review a little bit about Custer County and the rural schools. Prior to 1877, this area was part of Fremont County. And statehood occurred in 1876, and in 1877, Custer County became a county in its own right. The first public school in what is now Custer County was District 8 of Fremont County under the territorial government. There was a log cabin located 4 miles southwest of Silver Cliff, which is possibly where the Adobe School stands. Maybe that's more than 4 miles, but that's sort of where I placed it. It was taught by a Miss Verdon, and I think she was the daughter of a man who was very prominent in education fields in Colorado during that time. By 1881, Custer County boasted 20 school districts. Number one was Rosita, and I had 288 students. Rosita was hoping to become the state capital then, and there were quite a few people there. Then there was District 12 in Corita with 100 scholars. ULA out here had 55 students, and that's out. The building has burned. Wetmore had 55, I think, or 150. I didn't get the number down there correctly. There were 1,400 in 1881. Custer County had 1,400 students between 6 and 21, and in the county, and 1,100 of those 1,400 were enrolled in schools. So the rural schools all had pretty good enrollments. I'd like to comment a little bit about the living conditions of teachers before 1900, and maybe up through the 1940s, I don't know. In one school, it was out in the south end of the valley, the teacher had to share the bedroom with one of the kids in the family. And the house was not very solidly built because after a snowstorm, their bed would be have as much as 2 inches of snow on it in the morning. Schools were cold. There's nothing in the world as cold as a country school on Monday morning. Absolutely nothing until the fire is made. And the teacher has to get there in time to have it warm before the first students get there. In 1885, I found the records of a District 10, but I have never found a name for District 10. The teacher in this record, the teacher was paid $36 a month. In the 1930s, Froze Creek, which was out on the divide, Custer County divide, close to the county line, but I think they called it maybe the Focus School. Froze Creek was the general name. They had no water supply at school. Most of the schools didn't have a water supply. And I noticed in their records that they paid a local rancher $10 a year for supplying the school with water. In 1936 at the Willows School, 1946, I mean, which was the last year of existence as a school for Willows, Laura Lang, who's Miller Lou Vickerman's mother, was paid $1,350 per year, which was really an outstanding wage. Willows School District, Willows District, let's see, their records go back to, I don't remember now. I said I had 1913 here, but then we found records that predate that. And I think the first entry was a $5 donation given in the 1800s by someone to help start building a new school. In 1913, a teacher was paid $65 a month, which was really a good salary for 1913. Those are just some ideas. Now, I did my first 8 grades in a country school, the Dry Lake School out here in Brush Hollow, and my first 3 years of teaching were in country schools. And the first year I taught, there was no water supply there either, and I had to carry it. No provision was made. I lived about almost a half mile from the school, and I had to carry the water. And talk about water rationing, it was really put into effect. I am now going to talk a little bit about the impact of the curriculum on the values of the time, the era of the Little Red School. And in America, that extends from the 1600s to the 1950s, when practically all the districts were consolidated. There are a few isolated rural schools, one-room school in America, today, but they're very few. Maybe there may be 50 in the entire United States, and that's pretty stating it, you know, giving them a pretty good leeway. When we pick up the papers, the headlines always feature the wanton disregard of man for his fellow men, the satiation of the greed of a few at the cost of many. And that's exemplified by the savings and loan scandals and the antics of the Wall Street thugs. Then we read of pornography, flag burning, rioting. There's protests, teenage pregnancies, homicides, and other crimes of violence, child abuse and neglect, and substance abuse. And the list goes on and on. There's much hand-wringing and gnashing of teeth. And what's wrong with society, and why don't the schools teach values? Well, to the rescue, we should want to shore up the battlements and apply Band-Aids. And even our great seats of learning, such as Yale and Harvard, are acknowledging that society expects more from their graduates than the ability to pull off leveraged buyouts and inside training. And they are considering to, and may have already implemented, courses in ethics and values as prerequisites of graduation. This isn't anything new. Headlines today would have been suitable to the societies, for the societies of any era of history of which we know. America during the rural school era, from the 1600 to the late 1940s and early 50s, recognized that society is always on the verge of collapse. And it has realized that values can't be taught in a crash course between Christmas break and Easter vacation. Values can't be taught as a separate entity such as spelling, math, or grammar. Rather, values, ethics, or mores are acquired by osmosis from the home, the church, and in the past, more than now, the school. And the Little Red Schoolhouse era acknowledged that fact, that they had a role to play in the establishment of values. Beginning in the 1960s, emphasis was placed on the individuals, on the self, to do your own thing, regardless of the consequences to anyone else, including the core of society, which is the family. There came out of this philosophy the theory that the imparting of values, such as integrity, decency, compassion, chastity, the work ethic, patriotism, love of God, and love of fellow man, squelched the development of the individual, and the schools had no right to, quote, impose values on anyone. The individual had to be his or her own person. Well, now we're doing some second guessing, as I mentioned earlier, with Harvard and Yale. But that feeling really still prevails. Because just last week or week before last, I read a letter in the Canyon City Daily Record of complaint directed at school because they were implanting values to the kids down there. And boy, these parents better be aware and beware. So then how did society of the rural school era, recognizing the need for an ethos demanding that man live on a plane higher than chaos, impart values and ethics? Then the home and church played important roles, but school curriculum was a most important facet in turning out an orderly, law-abiding, considerate citizenry. And we're just going to consider in the curriculum reading, literature, and social studies as math, grammar, and spelling are skills, and while the early schools emphasize them, they don't necessarily impart out ideals. Let's take reading. The primary function of a reading program is to enable students to have a working mastery of easy reading. This is a highly technical process beginning with the decoding of symbols and ending with comprehension and the application of what has been read to whatever need the reader has. Readers used in Custer County from the early 1900s to the demise of the country schools emphasized citizenship, and not just a passing phase of so-called Americanization. The citizenship was portrayed in these selections to develop a genuine love of the country, a reverence for our pioneer forebears, and a respect for law and order and truth. Patriotism was heavily emphasized, and readers were rich in patriotic content. The American Book Company, with their Story Hour Readers series, influenced generations of Custer County students. Selections ranged from The Punishment of Evil and the Three Pigs, which is in the first grade reader, to Cratchit's Christmas, contrasting the mean-spirited, selfish, grasping Scrooge with the underpaid, overworked clerk, which we find featured in the seventh reader. Patriotism was treated from a simple story of the American Revolution in the third grade reader to Walt Whitman's majestic Captain, My Captain, in the sixth or seventh grade reader. Selections throughout all grade levels emphasize values that produced good citizens. Scott Forstmann was another publishing company that had a great social impact on America. And I am talking about the period really from 1900 on, because I don't have access to the McGuffey readers, which were definitely value-producing books, but I'm talking about those in the realm of my own experience, and I'll continue now about this Scott Forstmann. I've heard many complaints, usually by male educators at reading conventions, blasting the Scott Forstmann readers, stating they weren't relevant. During the decade of the 60s and 70s, there was a great hue and cry about everything having to be relevant, and nothing of any literary value was that I considered literary value was considered relevant. So that explains the deletion of historical material, patriotism, the old tales in the readers, good literature in general. Instead, kids were bombarded with material about divorce in the family, sibling rivalry, physical imperfection, self-esteem, and etc. Material that should have been presented by a counselor on a one-to-one basis, as needed by the individual. Scott Forstmann readers from the 1920s on through the 50s featured Dick and Jane. Dick and Jane appeared on the scene in about the late 20s, and they were with us for about 30, 40 years. It's my opinion that Dick and Jane and the Rural Electrification Association changed not only the face of Custer County, but the face of rural America, the entire face of rural America. We have Dick and Jane, Baby Sally, Spot, Puff, to provide the inspiration for the lifestyle, a desirable lifestyle, and the REA and TVA provided the means. And let's see why. Well, Dick and Jane were always clean. Their home was always in perfect order. Problems were solved without aggression. And male educators just said that isn't relevant. That isn't the way life is. And write readers telling the way life is. Well, your little kids don't like life the way it is sometimes. A little child can come in and say, I like the schoolroom because there isn't one thing in my home that's pretty. And so we have these, so Dick and Jane then gave the inspiration for personal cleanliness. Personal cleanliness was now more easily attainable because the REA, of course, provided the electricity to pump the water, heat the water. In Dick and Jane's stories, Daddy's car looked like Father's in Dick and Jane. Mom had electric appliances like Mother. Sue, Tom, and Christy had pretty clothes and smelled sweet and clean, as they knew Dick and Jane did. Pretty ranch-style homes replaced the tar paper shacks and the log cabins from which the rural school students came. So Dick and Jane and family were the role models of the 30s through the 50s. They were the Clevers, the Cosbys of that era. And though it took 3 decades for their lifestyle to become relevant, it was a lifestyle aspired to by the children of the Depression and the World War II period. We go into literature, and literature per se was not a special class, but was incorporated in reading and English classes. And I would like to comment on this because literary selections were reflected the fact that not everyone could go on to high school or college. And so there was a broad spectrum of literature, usually from the great books, because people wanted to be exposed to the classics, whether they could go on to college or not. Selections in the readers ranged from an episode in Homer's Odyssey in the third grade reader, which I might say is recorded almost verbatim from my college book. They expected the kids to really read well at every grade level. Then we have, as we go through these books here, we have selections from the great books, the Bible, Psalms, Joseph's stories. We have Dickens, as I previously mentioned. There's Victor Hugo, Jonathan Swift, and then there's Shakespearean works. All of these elementary readers. And I don't have one beyond the seventh grade level. Mrs. Lucy Beeman, who was the county superintendent from the late 20s through the 30s, prepared a poetry anthology for grade levels 1 to 8. And here is, she made one for each school. And this particular set was part of a government project. She selected the poems, and then it was a WPA fund or something which funded the labor, the girls that did the typing and hectographing. They didn't have a mimeograph. Hectographing of this material could earn some extra money. So she passed one out to every school, and the students were to copy and memorize all the poems for their own grade levels. To motivate this, which was a task for some, but for others was a pleasure, the student, upon recitation of the poem, had the privilege of tracing a poster and coloring it, which was really a treat because there was a dearth of color books then. At the end of the year, poems and posters were compiled into a notebook, and I still have one of mine. I have one, part of one anyway, from my fifth grade. And you can see that I never did quite master those pens that you dipped into ink. I could handle a fountain pen, but I couldn't handle those pen points. But we had to use those. And the pictures were Well, there's one under the greenwood tree, you know, and it was a good time filler. In later decades, then, memorization was frowned upon. Have the student get the meaning of what he's read, but forget the memory work. Rote work is just a waste of time. Then, about 20 years after that, educators decided that kids needed to develop their memories, so teachers had to trek off to workshops to learn how to teach the development of memory. And one exercise we were encouraged to put into use was to dictate perfectly meaningless list of words, then have the children write as many of those words as possible to develop their memories. Usually you dictated 12 or 15 words, and the good ones could remember four or five, and some of them eventually would get up to 9 or 10. Well, how much more useful to memorize math facts or geography facts and poetry? You could use it, and it serves a useful purpose. And as the ultimate in the enjoyment of poetry is to memorize it. Values in memorizing a poem. I wonder if a young zealot of today would be so anxious to burn the flag if he had memorized the stirring couplets from Marjorie Fritchie. And I'm going to read a little bit of that. Up from the meadows rich with corn, clear in the cool September morn, the clustered spires for Frederick stand, green-walled by the hills of Maryland. Round about them orchards sweep. I can't read fifth grade writing. I better, after all these years. Apple and peach tree fruited deep. Fair the garden of the Lord to the eyes of the famished rebel horde on that pleasant morn of the early fall when Lee marched over the mountain wall. Over the mountains winding down, horse and foot into Fredericktown. 40 flags with their silver stars, 40 flags with their crimson bars, flapped in the morning wind. The sun of noon looked down and saw not one. Up rose old Barbara Fitchie then, bowed with her 80 years. Bravest of all in Fredericktown, she took up the flag the men hauled down. In her attic window, the staff she set to show that one heart was loyal yet. Up the street came the rebel tread, Stonewall Jackson riding ahead. Under his slouched hat, left and right, he glanced. The old flag met his sight. Halt! The dust-browned ranks stood fast. Fire! Outblazed a rifle blast. It shivered the window pane and crashed. It rent the banner with seam and gash. Quick as it fell from the broken staff, Dame Barbara snatched a silken scarf. She leaned far out on the window sill and shook it forth with a royal will. Shoot if you must this old gray head, but spare your country's flag, she said. A shade of sadness, a blush of shame over the face of the leader came. The nobler nature within him stirred to life at the woman's deed and word. Who touches a hair on yon gray head dies like a dog. March on, he said. There's more to the poem, but if things of that nature were presented to the kids of today, I think they'd think twice before they'd burn the flag or do some of the other things that they do. Now, in the rural schools, social studies consumed a considerable block of time and was covered in all grade levels. Topics considered were family life, and it goes on down to cultural life, religion, which is something you wouldn't dare mention now, participation in community life, and all of these on a local, state, and federal levels. Considered also were conservation of human and natural resources, and music and dance and literature. Well, in the primary grades, topics were developed as units and were usually hands-on projects, which were stand tables, charts, and notebooks, and physical activities. Geography was an integral part of the, and it consisted of the physical, political, economic, and cultural aspects. Well, in history, Beard and Bagley, who were published by the Macmillan Company beginning in 1917 and revised until 1937, were the predominant force in the formation of American ethics prior to World War II. The first book in American history at the fifth grade level is a synopsis of the philosophy of the whole series, and emphasized were the growth of American nationality, the struggle to improve American life, the emphasis placed on in America upon individual opportunity, the growth of human and democratic ideals, the possibilities to rise from poverty and humble circumstances to high achievement, the place of America among nations, the work of women, the inventions and industry as determining influences in American life, and the spirit of American earnestness, which the Americans of each epoch have wrestled with in the problems of their time. To illustrate the details given a topic, one entire chapter is devoted to slavery in this book. There's 29 pages. And Beard and Bagley hit slavery very hard. Abraham Lincoln would have been very proud of them. And this was the text from which I, as a fifth grader, acquired my concepts of slavery and its impact on human dignity, both on the slave and the slave owner. Let's contrast that with the text from which I, a fifth grade teacher, in 1968 taught. I don't recall the publisher, but the text was a combination geography and history book. And I can recall verbatim the paragraph about slavery. And I quote, "The plantation owners had black people do their work. In return for their work, these people were allowed to live in little cottages behind the plantation owner's home and were given their food and clothing." That was it. The word slave was not used. Slavery was mentioned later as an issue in the Civil War, and that was all. There was no explanation of it. So what are the implications? What are the values? Well, ignore a situation. Well, shout on your obligations. Don't be responsible for your actions. Does a curriculum have an impact on values? And I leave you to mull that over. Irene wanted me to talk a little bit about the schools being used for purposes other than education, and I haven't been able to find any documentation, but I know from my personal experience and participation, or maybe accompanying my parents, that the schools and the East Hills area, some of them were used, well, they were used for church meetings. I remember the Salvation Army used to meet sometimes, and also a group known as the Disciples. They're not Christian church, but they were young men who went out in pairs and preached, and they did not accept salary. They worked for their room and board, and when they had to have another vocation, so that if and when they married, they would be able to support a family. They no longer preached after they married. Then schools were used as precinct sites for the general elections. They were also used for school elections. They were used for social activities. They were used for dances, box socials. Usually these were fundraisers for school needs. And that they would have a desk for anything from fuel to library books. They were used as clubhouses. The Grass Mountain Extension Club sometimes met at Dry Lake if they didn't meet at someone's home. Corita was used for the Corita Card Club until the building was burned, and apparently it was torched by someone. The Silvercliff School up here, which is now an apartment house, was used by the Black Slipper Club and the Silvercliff Club. And then, of course, there were the school programs and dances. And that's about all I have to say tonight. I would like to say that the state of Colorado, from the statehood until the 50s, until the demise of the country school, issued a course of study, and these were followed. Textbooks were selected to fulfill the goals stated in the course of study. And I think it would be really well if the districts would have a course of study, some people object to the state doing it. Probably it would be a hard thing to do now, but I think they need a curriculum guide. This is actually a curriculum guide. And right now, I don't know that they have a formal curriculum guide here, and there's lots of comments about it. People used to just sort of do their own thing in the schoolroom, and it was just anybody's guess what happened. And that's about all I have tonight. I thank you for your patience. Yes?
In Colorado, does the state have a state department of education, and do they issue books, print books, to the same?
They have a state department of education, but to my knowledge, they do not print books.
Well, California furnishes all the books, and they publish them. It's pretty much a curriculum for every school that they have to follow.
Mm-hmm. I think there's something to be said for that. However, there's something to be said, too, for having different publishing companies, because you get a different slant. You know, every publishing house has its own philosophy, and kids are exposed to different ideas that way and different viewpoints, because all material is slanted. There's no two ways about it. And so you have a more diverse development, I think.
What do you think caused this shift from personal responsibility and early patriotism and slipping over into, you know,
everything's
okay?
Well, part of it is the media, of course. But we bash the media a lot. There's a lot of good things to come out of the media, too. However, I have a personal grudge against Mr. Rogers' neighborhood. Mr. Rogers indoctrinated a lot of kids, I think, in the wrong way. I think he said he was the one that started when they were babies, saying that, you know, be yourself and don't be intimidated by anybody, and that included Mom and Dad and anybody else that got in their way. I don't have much regard for Mr. Rogers. A lot of people swear by him. Now, another thing, of course, the counterculture had an awful lot to do with it. And why the counterculture emerged, I don't know. Some people said it was a rebellion against our affluent society. We all acquired Dick and Jane status, and then the kids decided that that wasn't fulfilling, so they had to find something that was fulfilling. And let's see, who was the man in Harvard or Yale that started the people on the LSD route? And he started it out.
Larry, I think.
Yes, that was it. Yes. Well, I have one of his essays that you know, you extended yourself. The drugs extended your mind so that you could experience God more completely than you could without it. And I think that having a college professor's backing, and I think that really led a lot of kids astray. The drugs were okay. Then, of course, one of the teachers that we had here at the Westcliff School was a retired Navy captain who worked for many, many years in the Pentagon. He was very prominent in World War II. Collier's Magazine ran a long article about him and his activities in his leadership in the war in the Pacific. And he was in Asia during the Japanese, when the Japanese invaded China, which I think was in 1937. And before they invaded China, they had them stoned. And I remember as a little girl being bewildered by a story in Life magazine where they were trying to eliminate the drug problem there by just lining them up and executing them. And I was talking to my grandmother about it, you know, and she said, well, the state didn't have any right to take their lives, and or the country. But Mr. Gardner said that it's a military tactic as old as we've had, long as we've had wars, to get a population that you want to conquer stone before you move in. And he felt that a lot of, the Chinese were stoned, and the Japanese had very little problems, you know, winning their goals at that time. He felt that at the height of the drug culture here, that it was communist-backed. Of course, everything we blamed on the communists then. But it's very possible that it was started by them. Of course, now, Colombia, it's their livelihood, I guess, you know, to supply us with drugs. But I think the drugs, the media, and I think a lot of this indoctrination that you are number one, which is all right, but then, as I said, it doesn't matter who you walk on or hurt, you've got to be yourself, fulfill yourself. The lack of self-discipline, what it does is just foster a lack of self-discipline, I think.
Total rebellion.
Yeah, rebellion. And, of course, every age has had, I mean, there's a certain amount of rebelliousness in every age. We could read about rebellion with God and his stiff-necked Jews. He was always yelling at them, you know. So rebellion is old, too, but I don't know. It's certainly a different climate than World War II. World War II, the high school climate then was one of extreme patriotism, and they seemed to feel that they had a goal to accomplish. But then there's a difference between World War II and, let's say, Korea and Vietnam. We were attacked in World War II to start with. Then the Germans, with their submarine war, brought the declaration of war on themselves. And so we felt that we were protecting our homeland. And that's pretty, that's a very deep instinct in any warm-blooded creature, is to protect your territory. And so that explains part of the difference in the attitude that we have between the World War II and the Korean and Vietnam War. But I don't know why we have all the rebelliousness that we have now, because these kids are the best clothed, the best fed. They have more material objects than any generation in history has ever had. And I have no idea, unless it's because it was given to them. And that may be the whole answer. And what?
Betty, when you were talking about slavery, and you mentioned 1968, I believe, you know, just a paragraph or two on, could you as a teacher elaborate on that?
Oh, yes, and we did. And
some teachers probably didn't, but...
A lot of teachers didn't, but I remember the students in particular. I remember one girl said, well, I know why they had slaves. It was because they were too lazy to do their own work, and they didn't want to pay any wages. And I thought, for 10-year-old, that summed it up pretty well. Yes, we had a lot of... you had all the leeway you wanted. But you know, for a teacher that really might not have too much background in history or something, you know, she just let it go at that and might not do any research. And right now, in this period of our history, this time of our lives, our national life, the Civil War and all of that is getting to be pretty remote. In my dad's life, it was still pretty fresh in his mind because he was born in 1890. And so that just does... Well, in fact, World War II was is farther behind us than the Civil War was for him. So that was pretty important. And another interesting thing about this book, they emphasize the fact that a third or more of the book is devoted to the last 70 years. And the latest revision of this is 1934. So see where that puts you back. You know, they emphasize what would that be from about in the 1870s or beyond. The history book I used, of course, when I was in the eighth grade, stopped before the World War II started, because I was out of the eighth grade before 1941. And so history is really an ongoing thing, but as time goes by, probably in the next 100 years, probably none of these things will get more than a page that we spend pages on, unless you go into college and become a specialist.
Betty, what do you think of videotapes now dramatizing, say, the Civil War? Or some aspect of it, or videotape of Zebulon Pike and his exploration of this particular area.
Any audiovisual device is an excellent teaching aid, and I especially like videos because of their ease in operation, because you don't have to wrestle with a screen and thread the machines, and some of the machines are sort of aggressive. They'll bite you if you aren't careful. Some of them are just plain obstinate and won't thread at all. So I really like the way the videos operate. And I do think that there's other than the technical aspects, I really think that an excellent way to teach. And I remember a slideshow that a Chinese exchange student presented from Taiwan. And she had an excellent presentation. And I'm sure that the kids remembered everything because it was so well organized and the graphics were so clear and so beautiful that would certainly make an impression. And I think, though, that you have to be careful in selecting video material because, especially in the entertainment field, because teachers sometimes go into the pop culture thing. I think that has to be monitored pretty much by the administration to see that that the video material is of literary value or historical value or of any value, rather than just entertainment, because it can be, they can abuse it, and they sometimes do. Kids will bring their own tapes and con a teacher into showing them. And if you don't preview them, why, you might get into some pretty steamy stuff. But I think any audiovisual device is great, whether it's electronic or a well-done bulletin board. I think it's fine. No, we didn't have electricity in any of the schools. Well, one time, the first year I taught, our school went over to Ulay School, and Dan Riggs, who was game warden then, had a film on wildlife. And it was quite a treat for us. But that's the only school I know of that had electricity was the Ulay School.
I remember nearly 55 years ago, my dad had to take my mom, who was a school teacher in one room school, down to the county seat so we could buy a piece of rubber hose about so long. And you put a stick like this in the end of it, and that's what they had to use to spank the kids with. there was this movement against, you couldn't swat it with a ruler or something like that. It had to be this kind of certain specific kind of thing that you could spank the kids with.
So it wouldn't bruise them.
Spanking with that thing. But. I still remember it was made out of a red hose back in about real big around my finger or so.
Got a fairy t-shirt.
But we comment on discipline in a one room school that is contrasted with consolidated schools later.
Okay. In the one room school, I don't remember any discipline problems but one year. And it was caused by my younger brother and another boy and everything. then there was one other, and my mother, when my mother found out about it, well, that was the end of that. But one other time, there was a serious problem that my mother had to write and wrote about. She only wrote two notes to school in her whole life, because she had been a teacher and she didn't like the idea of writing notes. But there was a boy that was older than my brothers and I, and he influenced a boy that had a horse, that rode a horse to school. And they would take our lunch pails away from us, and then we would try to get them back, and they would try to run us down with the horse. So it was kind of scary, and so when my mom found out about it, she wrote a note that had enough clout that put a stop to that. But that wasn't on the school ground or in the school building. It was just on the way home from school. Then she had to write a note up here to high school because they had, I didn't go to this high school, but they had... They were really into hazing up here, and it wasn't eradicated until I came here to teach, and it just got so rough, and then it consisted of, everybody had to have his head dunked into the stool, which I think was absolutely gross, besides could have caused diseases. And dear Miss Kettle, would just laugh and say, that's an old Custer County tradition. And then they would take the boys out. I don't think the girls were bothered too much, but the boys always had to be taken to Lake Louise and have their britches taken away from them and made to walk home. Then one time they took I don't remember, they ganged up on Bob, who was pretty much of a, he could handle himself pretty well, and did, and he was the one that finally put a stop to it that year. But they got his shoes, and I don't know what they did with one of them, so here he came home, hippity-hopping on one foot, or, you know, with just one shoe, and it just incensed my mother so, and she really wrote a letter, and so the superintendent called an assembly for the whole school. He said, I have a letter here, and it's just smoking. And he said, there's a shoe missing, and it better be found, or I'm going to be out of a job. And they found it. But it finally resulted in... it was, you know, usually it's traditional for the seniors to haze the newcomers, but in this particular year, the juniors were the aggressive ones. The seniors gave them a nice party. Well, finally, they decided they couldn't stand anymore, and so Bob, they all called, they had a conference, so they decided which ones each boy would be responsible for. And they fought it out down here in front of where Martin at Hope's is now. And that was the end of the hazing. But the last year that they had hazing here was when Alma Lang, who just passed away yesterday, when her son, oldest son, was in there. And she had enough emphasis of what she had to say that was the end of it. We didn't have to put up with it anymore. And I think it's a terrible thing. I lucked out when I went to college because they were doing it over there until the year before I went there. And they had taken, it's Gunnison is so cold. And they took the girls out, the freshman girls out to the cemetery, which is a mile east of town. They went in the during the night, and they had to go as they were. Then they made them walk back. Well, this girl didn't have her bedroom slippers. She was just in her nightie. And she got pneumonia and nearly died. And so that was the end of the hazing there. They didn't do it. And it's good because the kids just, they don't have any sense, even if, no matter whether they're college seniors or high school seniors, you know. Pardon? Yes, it's mob rule. There are some pictures here of the, let's see, these are the pictures of the little rock school here. You see all of them. And one thing that's kind of interesting about that little rock school is there's a ledge on the foundation up about this high. And it starts out about this wide, and then it goes almost all the way around the building and tapers off. And generations of Westcliff kids would spend their recesses getting up there and walking around that ledge and trying to get clear around, you know. Well, it would peter out. Then nobody ever got...
There was one fellow that Ben had interviewed, and I can't remember who it was on the tape, and he claims that he got around that.
Oh, I'd like to know who it was, because I'd like to know who that was, because I... Well, I'm sure there's just been one, and he should... It should be a big sign up there.
His imagination.
Now, this is the little Dry Lake school where I went, and I'm in the eighth grade here. This big boy is dead. The teacher's dead. Dry Lake produced a man that, before my time, but he became a very, very brilliant man. And he went to MIT and worked on our NASA space program. He later became insane, and the end of his life was very bizarre and very sad, but at least he was very, very very, very intelligent, and he started out in a little and did a lot for our national security, in our space program, what have you, before his mind, his mental condition played out.
They say there's a thin line between genius and insanity.
Well, in that case, I think that probably it ran in the family. His sister taught at that school, and then she later committed suicide, and I think the mother murdered the father, and I don't remember. It was a bad situation. But anyway, Troy Graybeal was the one that Miss Kettle had here in high school. That was the shining light of all of her years of teaching, that she always referred to Troy. She taught physics and chemistry and biology, as well as home ec.
What was his last name?
Pardon?
What was his last name?
Graybeal.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very, very sad. And when the social worker, when they came back, he was finally placed at the state hospital for a while, or else his son was, I don't remember. But Ruth Lang had to go to the state hospital and sit in on a staffing. And they said there that they had never, ever, in all the history of the state hospital, dealt with a family that had been up so high intellectually that had fallen so low. And it was just really sad, really sad. I can't think of any. If you'd like to look at these, one thing that I saw, I have some of these old teachers' magazines. And one thing that I read last night, and it's really a good play, this is in 1952. And it was still all right to give a sacred Christmas play at school. Nobody would come and sue you. And this is the second Christmas. That's a different one, but that's when the family went to Egypt. But it's really, it's based on the family's trip to Egypt, you know, the situation leading up to that. And it's really neat. They put angels in it, all the things that you need to have a good Christmas play. But there are just as many plays and stories in here with the sacred theme as there are the secular. And we emphasize the sacred more in our Christmas programs here until just the last few years. We emphasize that more. And no criticism. Later the magazine started featuring Hanukkah as well as Christmas. But now I don't think you can have either one at school. I put these books out to see the scope of and what the kids have to read. I'll just read a In the rural schools, the teachers didn't the books were all furnished. When I came here to teach, the kids had to buy their own books for maybe 10 or 15 years before they finally decided that the district would pay for the books. And that was really hard because you couldn't change books as often. Some of the books became pretty outdated because the parents didn't want to buy new books, you know. So. They're in pretty good condition in the inside. Where I got most of these was out in the hall when they pitch them. This is the book I learned, My Story Hour Reader, I don't know if it came from my school, but that's the one that we used, and The vocabulary is pretty extensive.
We put in a new reader, a reading theory.
In the 60s.
That we teaching then really liked.
And it was the Lippincott series based on phonics. And by the time the kid had the third grade, he had a 5,000 word vocabulary, which in the old readers, you had about 600 or 700 by the time you got to the fifth grade. But when the new teachers came in, they didn't like it because teachers had to work just as hard as the kids did. And you had to work and work and work. And when you developed that vocabulary, would take it out of everybody. But they could read. I was so pleased. Lippincott started publishing these. And they just published one grade level a year, and then they added two. But by the time I got to fifth grade, that had Lippincott all those years, they could read their history. I mean, their social studies books. And I didn't have to teach vocabulary in the social studies. It was really a pleasure. But the new teachers just raved and ranted about them. And we used to say, well, you have to work at it. And you just have to make up your mind when there's some things that's going to be boring for our teachers. And development of vocabulary is one of them. It can be, you know, to a little kid. But, you know, I noticed a man on TV. Who is that football player that had gone through Oklahoma U that didn't have the reading skills? He was, what pro team does he play for now? Redskins. And he was kicked off the team because of his drug habit. Yes, I think so.
I don't know what you mean.
I do too.
Okay. He was talking about the fact he is a graduate of Oklahoma U, and he never learned to read. And so he is being tutored now, and I was sort of interested to notice that he was in the second grade level, and he was using a Lippincott phonics book. And so, you know, you just have to make up your mind that some of these people take more drill and more individual attention, and you may be bored out of your tree, but that's your job. If you have to be bored, so be it. You've got to get those skills across. And it might take, I have an idea that he will be reading fluently in 3 or 4 years, and what a shame he's missed out on all of that. All these years.
Well, it's like Memphis State. For 10 years, they never had a basketball player ever graduate. They used them. They never really, you know.
Not terrible.
And then they're done, they're done. Well, I think we ought to give Betty a good hand.
Thank you.
I'm sure you're